Looks like it's working. In Cam's opening Sunday school lesson on marriage, he went over the purposes of marriage according to the Westminster Confession of Faith. And I want to cover those one more time as we close this out. First of all, the purpose of marriage according to the WCF, the mutual help of husband and wife. What scripture does that come from? We typically look at Genesis 2:18, and the Lord said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." Another purpose of marriage is the prevention of uncleanness. You know, what do we mean by uncleanness? Satisfaction of the sexual desire to avoid the temptations of sexual immorality. Where do we see that? We see it in 1 Corinthians 7:2. "But because of the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband." And the other two purposes of marriage is what we're going to be talking about today. One is the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue being children born within a lawful biblical marriage rather than a forbidden union. And the verses we're going to we typically take those from is Genesis 1:28. "And God said to Adam and Eve, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it.'" And then again, he repeats this after the flood. He says to Noah and his sons in Genesis chapter 9, he says, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." So the increase of mankind is one of the purposes of marriage. Another purpose is the increase of the Church of Christ with the Holy Seed. And there's a couple of verses that the confession refers to as on this. And one is Genesis 18:19. "And God says this about Abraham, 'For I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring Abraham what he has promised him.'" And then in Malachi 2:15, we see that the Lord rebukes Judah for profaning the covenant by marrying a pagan. And he asks, "And what was the one God asking? Godly offspring. Our children are to build God's kingdom." I saw a quote from Doug Wilson that I thought it talks about the purpose of marriage. He kind of boils it down into a paragraph that I thought was worth mentioning. He says, "What is the chief end of marriage? It is the same as the chief end of man, which the Shorter Catechism describes wonderfully. The point of marriage is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. God is glorified in our marriages when we are true companions to one another, when we are privileged to raise up godly children, and when we help one another resist the temptations of sexual deviance." So that's kind of the basis of what is the purpose of marriage. Now we're going to be moving more into, okay, marriage and children. So I'm going to ask the question, is procreation of children the only legitimate reason for marital sex? So I would say if you were here for Brian's Sunday school lesson, you already know the answer to this. So as Brian pointed out in his teaching a few weeks back, marital sex is, in addition to producing children, God's gift to married couples as a way to express love and strengthen the bonds between husband and wife. And if we look at 1 Corinthians 7:3-5, we see the instruction to the husband and wife not to deny one another's conjugal rights. The duty here, we see that it remains, even if the couple is unable to have children, it still applies. So it's not just for the procreation. So if you look at our culture today, there seems to be a great reluctance among many to not have children. And I guess I'm always curious about what has changed. What is it about our culture that's changed? If we look at the U.S. fertility rates, that are, they're at an all-time low. And since 2007, the number of having children have dropped by 23%, which is well below the replacement rate. I would say a small percentage of this, thankfully, is to unmarried teen pregnancies have dropped. A lot of it, well, some of it, I would say, is also because of the fact that folks are prioritizing, the couples are prioritizing their careers ahead of having children. They're waiting till later, so therefore they can't have as many, even if they wanted to. But the Pew Research Center did a survey back in 2024, and it asked about, I think there were about 800 folks that it, as they went through this process, they said, have you ever had children or do you ever plan to have children? And I thought it was interesting, the responses that they had. Almost 60% of them said, why I don't want to have children? I just don't want to. I've got too many hobbies. I've got too many interests that children would just interfere with. And it's interesting that about 80% of those that said, that 57% said it would not allow them to purchase the things that they want to purchase. As you would expect, about 60% of those said success in my job, it would hinder, and so on. When they ask that question, 44% of the folks said they want to focus on other things. 38% said they had concerns about the state of the world. 36% said they can't afford to raise a child. 26% had concerns about the environment. 34% haven't found the right partner, and 20% said, I just don't like children. It was interesting that of the whole number, only 13% said they don't plan to have children because of either infertility or medical issues. So, how should that, as Christians, how should we look at managing everything? As Christians, should Christian couples seek to have children? The sexual union of our parents, Adam and Eve, implies what? Procreation. And fulfills God's command to be fruitful and multiply. It's only in the modern era that we miss this obvious point. I want to read a quote from a lot of you have read Katie Faust's book, Them Before Us. And in the book, I think it's in the foreword to the book, Robert George writes, marriage has the shape it has historically had and is governed by the same norms that have historically governed it precisely because it is the unique, appropriate setting for the conceiving and rearing of children. Indeed, historically, in our law, marriage is consummated, completed, perfected by the child-conceiving act. That is the act that fulfills the behavioral conditions of procreation. Even couples who are not able to have children of their own consummate their marital bonds by performing the act that would otherwise result in the coming to be of a child. And the relationship they enter into, marriage, is what it is, with the contours and norms that it has exclusively, with the contours and norms that marriage has, exclusivity, fidelity, permanence of commitment, and so on, because of its aptness for children. So once we understand this, that the sexual union of our parents, Adam and Eve, allows obedience to God's command, we can see that procreation is one of the key ways in which Eve is a helper fit for Adam. Eve is Adam's companion, his co-worker, friend, lover, and most especially, the wife with whom Adam will enact the creation mandate to be fruitful and multiply. So, what is the answer to the question, should married couples seek to have children? Yes, if able. The gift of marital sex is, at its core, for procreation, for filling the earth, and for growing Christ's church. So, what are the obligations? What obligations come with marriage, with the gift of children? Well, there's a lot of those. And we don't have nearly enough time today for me to go into all of them. But there was one verse that I want to first focus on, and one word in that verse that I would like to focus on when we talk about obligations of the marriage with children. And that's Psalm 127, 3 through 5. It says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them." So I want to focus on that one word, heritage, because I wasn't real clear. I had to look it up and see what it means. And typically, it goes to it has the meaning of an inheritance. When you talk about heritage, an inheritance. Alan Ross, in his commentary on the Psalms, says this about an inheritance. He's talking about these verses specifically. He says, "An inheritance brings with it great opportunity. It also requires responsible use. On the one hand, it is the heir's possession, a gift. But on the other hand, it is a trust to be developed, improved, and enjoyed. So children are a gift from God, but a gift that requires care and development if the child is to grow to be righteous and wise." Here's the key to what he's saying here. This metaphor suggests something of the responsibilities of parents as well as the value of the child. Children are a gift, a trust, and that gift is from God himself. So I think that's a key piece when we start, talking about the obligations that we have. It is a gift from God. Children are something that have been given to us, and not just for our joy, which is a big part of it, but it's also is an inheritance of something that God gives to us with the expectation that we're going to improve upon it, that we're going to grow, that we're going to use it for his glory. A number of years ago, I taught a monthly class on leadership. And I'm going to refer back to some of that today as we talk about parents and raising children, because I think, at least in my mind, it's helpful. I hope it's helpful to you. And there's two sides to leadership. And the first side is, as a leader, it's not really about me and you. We've got a role to play. We've got a job to fulfill. So it's not really about me and you. It's accomplished in that job is those that we are going to be supervising, those that we're going to be assisting. You see that a lot in work, those that are working under you. It's not about you. It's really about making the best life for them. Now, the flip side is, it's all about you. It's all about me. And that's what the two things that I'm going to get into here today when we talk about parenting, when we talk about marriage and raising children. So first off, it's not about you. Raising kids is hard work. Anyone want to disagree? Raising children requires a superficial love of 1 Corinthians 13. It is not self-seeking. Ben Sasse, he's written a lot of good stuff lately, by the way, and he's had a lot of interviews. If you haven't had a chance to hear what a dying man has to say about life, I fully encourage you to listen to some of them as a solid Christian guy. But Ben says, the family is the source of the habits that we're going to need to cultivate the next generation. Creating the habits that foster the love of the good, the true, and the beautiful begins at home. The bad news of what I'm suggesting is that it's deeply inconvenient. The good news is that parenting has always been inconvenient. It's the ultimate inconvenience. And surprise, surprise, of all places, I found Daniel Henninger's commentary in the Wall Street Journal a while back talking about children. And he says, what else can you say? Raising kids isn't easy or cheap. Kids are people, and people cause problems that need solutions. When you become a parent, your life totally changes. You get no sleep. You have to give up a lot of fun and enjoyable things that you used to do, and you never have the time to yourself. And yet, nothing in life comes close to giving you as much joy and satisfaction. He says that's a cliche because it's true. Nothing comes close, not friends, not romance, not career success, not financial security, not even the Grand Canyon. Nothing. I thought of you when I read that. Yeah, Jeff. In 1 Colossians 1:24, Paul tells the church that he rejoices in what he is suffering for the church's sake. Likewise, in marriage, we rejoice when God has gifted us children and given us the honor of laboring and suffering for their sake. From Colossians 1:28 through 29, it is clear that Paul desperately wants every believer in Christ to be presented complete in their faith and mission. He wants every Christian to be fully equipped disciples for Jesus, and he works tirelessly to that end, sacrificing his time, his health, his freedom, his very life. And that same example should describe our labor of raising children. Like Paul in these verses, we can say, putting our children in these verses, we proclaim him, admonishing our children and teaching each one of them with all wisdom, that we may present all of our children complete in Christ. For this purpose also I labor, striving according to his power, which mightily works within me. Raising children is the primary ministry of married couples. If you're able to have children, it is the primary ministry. It's not the only ministry, but it's our primary ministry. Perfect time. One other quote from the book, Them Before Us. If we want to have children in the way that we should want them, and not merely as things to satisfy adult desires, then it will seem natural indeed. It will be obvious that we are to put them before us. So, it's not about me, it's not about you. But now here's the flip side. It's all about you. Pastor Andrew Murray, in his 19th century book, How to Raise Your Children for Christ, which if you haven't read it, I highly recommend, probably my favorite on parenting. He says, the principle that lays at the root of all true education is that whatever I desire to make my child, I must first be myself. It's all about you. How the marriage, this is not him, this is me. How the marriage goes, so goes the family. You're being watched every minute of every day. Even country music songwriters know this. See Rodney Atkin's song, I've Been Watching You. I got that one in, Carl. I've said many times that children can spot hypocrisy much better, much easier than adults can. And I truly believe that. They know when mom and dad are at odds with one another, as much as we may try to hide it from them. They know when their father loves their mother and when he doesn't. They know when their father is shirking his leadership role. They know when their mother respects their father, and they know when she doesn't. A strong marriage where love between spouses is visible and tangible provide security and stability for children and an atmosphere in which they can thrive. Children come to know the love of God through the love their parents have, not only for them, but for each other. Your marriage should be a picture to them, Christ and his bride, the church. You want to teach good theology in the home? Selflessly love and respect one another. Not just superficially in front of the kids, but really love and respect one another. Kids know that they are not the center of their parents' universe. Kids need to know that they are not the center of their parents' universe and that your marriage is a priority. Kids don't want to be the center of their parents' universe. They want to feel safe under the canopy of their parents' love. Imagine that you would have the fear that you would have living in a world where God is not supreme. That is how children feel when they grow up in a home that their parents do not prioritize their own marriage. An unstable marital love creates a poor foundation in the home for parenting. I said I was going to try to avoid getting much into parenting, but I can't resist it right here. We talk about kids don't want to be the center of their parents' universe. I would also add this comment here. They also don't want to be in control of their parents. I'm going to repeat that. Just as they don't want to be the center of their parents' universe, they don't want to be in control of their parents. When they whine and cry and constantly say no, this is their plea for someone to set firm boundaries and make sure they stay within those boundaries. When I hear a child whining, complaining, what I hear him say is, would someone please take control of me? And no more of that, I'm going to count to three. I don't want to be in charge. Help me. Okay, that's it. As I said before, in the midst of the chaos of child raising, make your marriage a priority. Your children need you to do this, and your marriage needs you to do this. One glorious day, you will find you have an empty nest. Plan for it now by making marriage a priority today. Sadly, 25% of marriages end after children leave home. We call that the empty nest syndrome. Sad, sad comment. Over the years, couples have prioritized parenting over maintaining their relationship, and it's very, very easy to do. Been there, done that. Once children leave, some couples realize that they've developed communication breakdowns, or they have difficulty reconnecting at an emotional level. There's a lot that can be said with this, but I'm just saying, guard this. Don't let this be you. Another aspect of it's all about you is that both husband and wife need to develop their leadership skills, especially the husband, but I would say also the wife, since the wife is going to be with the child typically most of the day. This is hard to follow. But I'm going to read it anyway. One of the things that has been a real help to me over the years in leadership is called A Failure of Nerve, Edwin Friedman's book. I know a lot of you have read it also. But I want to read a section in there about leadership, because I think I'm not very good at coming up with these ideas myself, but I can spot a gem when I see it. And to me, this was a real gem. So if you will, bear with me. I'm going to read a page out of it. He says, I came to realize that what I had been observing, first of all, that he is a counselor, a PhD in counseling. He's done a lot of different things, but he's counseled from families all the way through government agencies, military, a lot of counseling in his years and years and years and years that he spent counseling. And this is the result of a lot of those counseling encounters. I came to realize that what I had been observing with regard to families for more than a quarter of a century was identical. I began to see that if I were to consider with a two or three generation perspective, the thousands of families I had observed go into crisis, whether the crisis was due to sudden loss, acting out children, severe illness, intense polarized marital conflict, financial problems, or other external impacts. Without question, the single variable that most distinguished the families that survived and flourished from those and those that disintegrated was the presence of what I refer to throughout this work as a well-differentiated leader. Okay, so what is a well-differentiated leader? He says, I want to stress that by a well-differentiated leader, I do not mean an autocrat who tells others what to do or orders them around. Although, any leader who defines himself or herself clearly may be perceived that way by those who are not taking responsibility for their own emotional being and destiny. He goes on to say, rather, I mean someone, a self-differentiated leader. I mean someone who has clarity about his or her own life goals, and therefore someone who is less likely to become lost in the anxious emotional processes swirling about. I mean someone who can separate while still remaining connected, and therefore can maintain a modifying, non-anxious, and sometimes challenging presence. I mean someone who can manage his or her own reactivity by the automatic reactivity to the automatic reactivity of others, and therefore be able to take stands at the risk of displeasing. He says, it is not as though some leaders can do this and some cannot. No one does this easily. And most leaders, I have learned, can improve their capacity. So how do we develop those leadership skills? Well, the Bible has a lot of cast of characters that give us good examples of this. And I would recommend, if you want a good place to start, the book of Nehemiah is a great book to show what leadership looked like. J.I. Packer has a book that I've often referred to called A Passion for Faithfulness that is really about Nehemiah's leadership in a really tough situation. So for parents, I would highly recommend taking a look at that. Next, a husband's love for his wife and a wife's respect for her husband will impact your children and grandchildren's future in ways that you cannot imagine. I want to tell you a story, if I can get through it. It's very personal. Debbie has told this story to many, many young wives, and some of you sitting here, I'm sure, have actually heard it. I cannot tell the story as emotionally well as Debbie does. So you might want to get her to give you her version of the story one day. Talking about how our actions as husband and wife impact our children. How our obedience to God in love and respect impact our children's lives. And the lives of our grandchildren. And the lives of a lot of other people. We lived in Shreveport, Louisiana back in the 90s. I won't go into all the details. There came a time when, as the head of my family, I felt I had to find another church for our family. I looked around. The only real option that I could find for us was 60 miles away in a town called Ruston, Louisiana. So we started making that drive every Sunday. I should add on top of this, my wife was homeschooling four kids at the time. As you can imagine, when I first suggested it, it didn't go over very well. The church in Ruston had a weekly potluck lunch after service, sometimes at the church, sometimes at someone's home, that we were highly encouraged to attend. They also had an evening worship that at times we would attend. Debbie could have easily sat me down and said, you know, this is just not going to work. I don't know what you're thinking. I got Monday coming up. I got four kids I got to get school ready for. I can't do this. She could have done that. But among tears, she said, okay. There's repercussions to that. We did this for a little under a year, and I got transferred to my job to Birmingham. So we only had to make that drive for a year. And after being in Birmingham for a while, we ended up settling at Reformed Heritage Presbyterian Church. There was a student from Louisiana that we got to know while we were in Ruston Church. He was a student at Louisiana Tech. His name was Brad Bourgeois. We became friends. He'd come over to the house. We got to know him and some of the other students there. And so when we were here in Birmingham, we were meeting at Burney Points Baptist at the time. And this other guy, Greg Bourgeois, had enrolled in med school at LSU, but at the last minute, he got accepted at UAB and decided to make a change. So he came to med school. Might be him. Hey, that was perfect timing, Greg. So he came to wasn't that like a week before you were supposed to start or something like that? Yeah. So anyway, Greg comes to Birmingham for UAB Med School.
Was the very end of my last year of school, yes.
Yeah. And this guy that we had met at Ruston Church when we were driving the hour each way, Brad Bourgeois, told his brother, Greg, find out where the Woods are going to church. That'll be a good church. So Greg shows up one day at Burney Points and visits, and he hangs around and he stays, and he actually starts dating our oldest daughter. And then one day he shows up with this other guy, his roommate, Grady Maddox. And Grady ends up marrying our second daughter. What if Debbie had said no? What if we'd have never got to know Greg Bourgeois? That other Bourgeois, Brad Bourgeois. What if we'd have never got to know him? I think about that often. But the story goes even further than that, in that I got to know the pastor in Ruston fairly well. And he would still check on us about once a quarter since after we moved here. You know, he knew that we were at Reformed Heritage, which later became TPC. He knew that we were there, and he called one day and he said, hey, are y'all still looking for a pastor? We didn't have a pastor at the time. We had an interim pastor. There were not many families, maybe 10 to 12 at the most. Petersons were there with us at the time. He said, y'all still looking for a pastor? And I said, yeah, they still are. I wasn't an elder at the time. And he said, I think Rich Lush may be interested. And I said, I don't think Rich would come to Birmingham. And, I think Rich may be interested. So I said, well, I had met Rich before. I'd heard Rich speak when I was in Louisiana. He was at Monroe Church when we were going to Ruston, so I had heard him. I had a high respect for Rich Lusk. And so I went to the session at Reformed Heritage, and I said, there's this guy in Louisiana that's right now, he's working on staff at the Monroe PCA Church. I've heard he may have an interest, and if he does, I would grab him right away if I were y'all. I told him what I knew about him, and they set up a time with Rich to go over and visit with him. They listened to some of his sermons, and long story short, hired Rich in 2004, 22 years ago, and a lot has changed since then. I have 14, soon to be 15 grandchildren that will be sitting under his teaching. Raised four children sitting under his teaching. And the church has obviously grown quite a bit. I tell you that story just because if not for Debbie respecting her husband's leadership, I don't know how much of that would have happened. I could tell you a lot of other stories similar to that. I'm getting to be an old man, and I know those stories now. And as I look back, they start making sense to me. But I'm going to stop with that one. But wives, respect your husbands. Moving on. I can't resist, Carl. One more country music songwriter. These are my final comments, by the way. I'm gonna finish up on marriage and children. Actually, I'm finishing up marriage. This is the line from one of my most loved country music songwriters, Tony Lane. Some of you have heard him. The line goes, "Honor your children walking through this life. Honor your sister, brother, husband, and wife. Honor this slow dance that goes by too fast, because we're here today and we're gone like that. We're here today and we're gone like that." Yes, I have been reading the book of Ecclesiastes again. There is a book that I just stumbled upon. It's by David Gibson. It's called Living Life Backwards. If you haven't read it, it's a good read. I try to read most books that I find on Ecclesiastes because I've grown over the years to love that book. There's something that, and the reason I bring it up this morning is there's something that David Gibson encourages us to do. And I think it does apply to marriage, so I'm going to read it to you. He says, Ecclesiastes makes a very simple point. Life is complex and messy, sometimes brutally so, but there is a straightforward way to look at this mess. The end will put it all right. The end, when we stand before God as our Creator and Judge, will explain everything. Left to our own devices, we tend to live life forward. One day follows another. The weeks turn into months. The months turn into years. We do not know the future, but we plan and we hope and we dream where we will be and what we would like to be doing and who we might be with. We live forward. Ecclesiastes teaches us to live life backward. It encourages us to take the one thing in the future that is certain, our death, and work backward from that point until all the details and decisions and heartaches of our own lives, and to think about them from the perspective of the end. It is the destination that makes sense of the journey. If we know for sure where we are heading, then we can know for sure that what we need to do, we know for sure what we need to do before we get there. Ecclesiastes invites us to let the end sculpt our priorities and goals, our greatest ambitions, and our strongest desires. There's also a quote in this book from James Russell Miller that says, "Nothing brings such pure peace and quiet joy at the close as a well-lived life. Start at the end, work back." And so lastly, I'll just leave it at this. Life is a vapor, Ecclesiastes. Life is a vapor, a mist, a puff of smoke. We're here today and we're gone like that. God requires, but it is also a gift God has given to us. I'm going to start that piece over. Life is like a vapor, a puff of smoke. We're here today and gone like that. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. That is what God requires, but it is also a gift that God has given to us. That is what will bring you true joy. That is what will bring your children true joy. And that is what will build the kingdom of God.